Welcome back to the Mama Distinct Show. I'm Shirley Nordrum.
I'm Sharon Nordrum.
And today we're visiting with Dennis Montgomery on his beautiful property that he calls East Nary. Beautiful property, but thank you for taking the time to sit and visit with us. We've been talking a bit about your pioneering days of coming here and buying property. And our show's about just visiting really cool people. And you are, like, a really cool person in my book. He's blushing, he's hiding, putting his turtleneck up. No.
That's really nice from you.
So thank you for sitting down with us today. I really appreciate it. You know, everything about you is fascinating to me. You have stories of starting co-ops, of gardening. I know you're a musician. I think you're a cool guy, so.
Whoa, did I need you guys to come? Because most of the time I don't feel that way.
You don't feel cool and awesome?
No, I don't, mostly.
Are you from Minnesota?
No, I'm from Dayton, Ohio.
So how did you end up in East Nary?
It is an interesting story. First of all, I am an old hippie if we talk about where we come from.
Yeah.
For me, it's a subculture. I was an alienated youth, right? We all know what's alienated mean? It means you don't fit in, you don't feel, you don't buy into the values, you know, of mainstream middle suburban America. And that's what kind of hippies were. They were, we're going to start something new, and it's not going to be about materialism, and it's not going to be about getting ahead, and it's not going to be about paycheck and a career. So I, even before I ever heard of a hippie, I wanted to either be a hobo or a beatnik. All my teachers told me I was a chronic underachiever.
Depending on your perspective.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what I was trying to achieve was not academic excellence in a career, even at an early age, you know. So, you know, I was kind of drawn to all that. And so musically, I was drawn to folk music because that was kind of that, and the people's music. And then you start reading about other poets and artists and the political differences, you know, the labor movement and things like that. Was all stuff that I was reading about when I was in high school and not passing my classes. And I wanted to be that. And so sometimes I look in retrospect, and it is kind of like when you're an adolescent, you're trying to find your identity. And so, I mean, I was trying to do that and trying to find that. And I thought that was cool because that's, you're an adolescent, you want to be cool. That's what I thought was cool. But I didn't know what it meant. So then I started reading more. So you read things like great religions, because I was raised in no religious training at all. So I read about the great religions, and I would, you know, read about them all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, the civil rights thing was happening big, you know,
right.
We're talking about early 60s, mid 60s. So I start reading, I think the first book I ever read was Black Like Me.
Oh, I love that book.
About a white guy who wondered what it would be like to be black. So he shaved his head and darkened his skin and lived as if he was black in the South. But after that, I started reading read Sammy Davis Jr.'s autobiography. And then I read Malcolm X's autobiography.
Oh, I love him.
And then I read Eldridge Cleaver's autobiography. And I read Dick Gregory's autobiography, and I read Custer Died for Your Sins.
Yeah, Blind Gloria.
I mean, so that's what I was reading in high school.
We read a lot of the same books in high school.
And then the hippies came, you know, and I realized, oh, maybe I'm not a beatnik. So I got into that big time, you know, and so by the time I left, I graduated high school, I was still 17, I just started hitchhiking around, spent about a year or two, went to Colorado and washed dishes and, you know, just went to Boston. I mean, I went all over the country for a couple of years. But, oh, during the high school times, too, the other big issue was the war, right?
Right.
I mean, it was like, you know, it's like, I'm not going to do this. I think everything I read about it said it was immoral and wrong and illegal. And I was reading Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and it's like, I'm not going to do that. So I was a conscientious objector, which wasn't an easy thing either. It was denied first, and then you have to go to a hearing with the board. And
I didn't realize that they allowed conscientious objectors in Vietnam.
And actually it changed during then. Originally, when I did it, it was supposed to be on religious or spiritual grounds, which was really hard for me, not being raised in a church.
Right.
And usually it was like, if you were from a church, like the American Friends, for example, that are clearly against it, or a lot of Catholicism has a history of anti-war and other. But I went and talked to because I wanted to be honest, too. I wasn't trying to just be a draft. I mean, I could have dodged the draft other ways. I mean, I know lots of people faked. You could get out if you were gay. You could get out if you went to college. You could get out if you were married. You could get out if you had any mental problems. And I knew a lot of people that faked some of those things to get out. But I was going to say, no, I'm going to do it. So I went to the American Friends, and they kind of helped me talk about what I believed and put it in a way that would meet the spiritual religious things, even though I didn't have a religious background, and be able to talk to the draft board. But yeah, we've always had conscientious objection since Civil War, I think. And you know, actually, when I moved here, I met a bunch of World War II conscientious objectors, which was kind of interesting. But anyway, that was just part of who I thought I was and who I felt like I was. But then I'd always loved the outdoors. I had uncles that taught me to hunt, and you know, we'd hunt rabbits and pheasants, and that was the biggest part of my childhood, was going hunting with my uncles. I've still got my 1897 Winchester pump shotgun my grandfather had. That's still my shotgun I use. They also went fishing, so they came to Minnesota fishing, and when I was about 12, they brought me to Minnesota with them. First we went to Outing, and then we ended up going up to Tall Moon because we heard there was better fishing up there. And so for about 4 or 5 years, every summer I'd spend a week or two up in Tall Moon fishing. And so I, you know, just loved it. And then as the years went on, it was like, I wanted to do this back to the land thing, you know, and see if I could. The goal was no longer to be a hippie or a hobo, you know, but maybe I could live off the land without having a job. Just get what I need to eat, you know, and stay warm. And that was the goal. And of course, that never happens. Because you still need cash in today's world, you know, or some kind of trade, you know, thing. But anyway, that was the idea. That was the ideal, you know, and ideally it would have been with a whole group of people. But I knew some other people from, because then land was really cheap up here in the mid-70s. And we'd get these books, United Farm, and you'd look at these old farms and resorts that were really cheap. And I knew some guys, it just happened, some guys from my home, two of them went together and bought a farm in Guthrie, and another guy was renting a place up in Debs. And so, I was living on a farm with a bunch of people in southern Indiana. I'm working at a state hospital. Because I started working in state hospitals for my alternative service to the draft. You know, so instead of doing time in the service, I worked in state hospitals. Got into that very seriously, you know, doing that kind of work. And in my head, I thought, okay, I can do this work because it's like social justice work. You know, it's like taking care of people and talk about people who are oppressed. You can't, people in a in the old state hospital were the max as far as no rights. And so I worked for the state of Ohio Department of Mental Health for like 8 years. And during that time, I went to a community college and got a degree in mental health technology. So it was like to be a technical mental health worker. And the whole idea was, we don't need more PhDs and doctors and MDs. We need people who work with somebody side by side, helping them, you know, implementing the theories and implementing the treatment, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, you spend 8 hours with the person instead of 20 minutes, you know, and you really work with them. And then the idea at the time was state hospitals were closing, so how do we take those services to the community? We worked in a hospital in Cincinnati that when I started there, and they'd already dropped the population quite a bit, but when I was there, it was like about 1,000 people, I think, by then. It was down to about 1,000 people.
Down to 1,000 people?
Yeah, it had been bigger. The buildings were built pre-Civil War.
1,000 people had a mental illness?
If you were developmentally disabled, you have this condition. And it's a medical model, right? So we got to cure this condition. Well, it's incurable. So we'll put you in the hospital until you're cured. Well, you're never cured. So you never get out, or very rarely get out. Rather than, this is a condition you have, we're going to help you learn how to live with it. Like, you know, diabetes. If you have diabetes, it might not cure it, diabetes, but you can learn to live a healthy, satisfying life with it if you manage it correctly. Yeah. Same thing could be said for schizophrenia. You may have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, but there are things you can do to manage it and live a productive life, right. satisfying life with it. There used to be a National Institute of Mental Health that planned the mental health system.
Oh, yeah.
And provided funding for the mental health system. And part of that was to train new workers to have knowledge and skill, but not necessarily be doctors, because that's not what we needed. But that whole thing stopped, and that's what scares me now about destroying institutions. In the 80s, they, from budget cuts, tax cuts, they did away with the whole department. There is no more National Institute of Mental Health. Did.
So now they've just sort of privatized everything.
There you go.
Insurance.
But in the 80s, that whole process of planning for, but all that got wiped out. And so when you destroy those big national institutions, I mean, that had, work had been done since the early 50s, you know, because during the, right after World War II, they realized that the institution could not continue. They were, couldn't keep putting more people in and not letting people out, and they were horrendous conditions, and they were underfunded.
Yeah.
And so they had to make a plan, and so all through the 50s and 60s, they developed these plans, started implementing them in the 70s, and in the 80s, just cut it off. For years of working in those situations, it was like, I'm done. And then we had these friends up in Minnesota, you know, and so we came up to visit them in, I think it was June of 76. And then that was it. Maggie and I came up and we visited the folks up in Debs and visited the folks in Guthrie. And then we went home and said, we're moving to Minnesota next spring, and just started buying tools and books about gardening and books about building. And
had you guys ever gardened or built or done any?
I'd done a little bit of gardening before that, but not much. You know, we got up here and started looking for places. And I think we were originally hoping we could find an old farm, and we didn't. We ended up just getting empty land and woods, which was had its own cool, but made it really hard to have them.
Starting from scratch.
Yeah, and I mean, even the garden out there for years, because we didn't have any heavy equipment, so it was like if there's a tree stump in the way, you garden around it for 5 years till it's rotten enough to chop it out. You know? Building it out a little bigger this year and digging up a little more sod. But yeah, we just decided to do it. And so then, you know, it's like, what are we going to do? Where are we going to live in? Maggie was pregnant, you know, with our first kid. So we found this house, and the Gerkes moved it over here for us. And, you know, it didn't have electricity, and we didn't have no well. We got the well and electricity after about 3 years. Melting snow to rinse diapers, you know. I mean, Maggie, I can't believe what she went through. The first job I got was with Bicap. And I had this old 1970 International pickup truck that I had to be at the high school at 7 in the morning to get these little four-year-olds off the bus. And so it was really important I wasn't late. And so I would literally drain the oil out of the truck at night in the winter and bring it in a bucket and set it in the house. So, and bring the battery in. So in the morning I could put the battery back in the car, pour the oil back in the car, and it'd start right up.
You know? Oh my gosh.
But sometimes I'd get oil all over me. You know? But we started figuring out how much we spent on kerosene and how much trouble that was and how scary dangerous it was, you know, with the babies. We started figuring out how many extra trips we took to town to do laundry, you know, with the babies, you know, and it's like, we would probably save money, you know. So, I mean, I don't think of, today, I still think of electricity not as a necessity. I mean, in the city, it really is, I guess. But out here, I thought it was an inexpensive luxury to have it, you know, and it... And I wouldn't want to go back to it, but the kerosene, you know, I remember doing, because I was working for some mental health organizations at the time. Actually, I was president of the National Organization of Human Services for mental health workers. It was like a national organization. There were only about 400 or 500 of us nationally, but... You know, but I remember having like 4 or 5 kerosene lamps in a circle on the table so I could write stuff and, you know, and read and stuff at night. But yeah, it was pretty exciting times. And then when things, like when they first started community mental health programs here, it was a grant to start services for the mentally ill up here. And I'd been working for BICAP with this grant job to set up a program for community mental health. And I couldn't not apply. And if I'm working, I might as well do that because that's what I knew and I could make more money doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became the Apartment 3 program, which is now Hope House.
Oh, cool.
You know, and so it was 1980 that started. And Lila George was working on a similar program in Cass County. So, and that she and I got to know each other a lot. She taught me a lot about Native things, taught me a lot, you know, about living here, about being around Cass Lake. Mike Schmidt was one of the first people I met when I moved here because he was living not far by and went by on his horse and buggy one time and got to know him a little bit, you know. And, you know, it's just where it was. Working for BICAP, I also worked for a mental health center's chemical dependency program because there was none up here, you know, at that time. And so we, alcohol and drug information and referral center. But there was a guy I worked with then named Pat St. Clair. Boy, he taught me a lot, too. And what he did, it was kind of out of our office, but he started going, and Mushkowizen had just, I hope I'm saying it.
Mushkowizen
had just opened. And so he would go into the jail and get people out, go to treatment. But that's when I first got aware that 90% of the people in jail are Native.
Yep, it's still, it may be a little higher now.
Some women that I knew from that neighborhood, you know, from that work, were first starting the Northwoods Coalition too. So, so they kind of pulled me in to be on the board there. Because they were getting a lot of pressure that they needed a male.
We just interviewed those guys, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
So there's a lot of connections coming together here.
That was like 79, 80, you know.
It's good to know that those programs are still going. It's disappointing to hear that the statistics haven't changed.
Yeah, and some of it, you know.
I mean, like, how hard do people got to work?
And you see progress, you know, and you're going, and that's what I meant by up and down, you know. You see you're getting there, and you think, oh, man, we're almost there. And then shifts, and budgets change, and priority change, and programs get cut, or they're funded at the same level when they're serving 200 people that they were funded at when they served 50 people. You know, so meanwhile, the jail's taken over. That's all. You know, we've criminalized mental health issues.
We've criminalized a lot of just humanness. I think it got worse when they started to privatize jails, you know.
That is a moral outrage.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, to earn money by incarcerating.
So we're sliding backwards rather than where you guys were like working to shove things uphill.
That's part of the immigration thing. Yeah. It's motivated by money. The more money we detain, somebody's making profits at that. The only way you can make I guess I'm not opposed to capitalism in the marketplace in some areas, but it doesn't work in all areas of society. There are some things that society needs that aren't profitable, you know, and that should be done publicly. And I believe that really strongly. And that doesn't make me a socialist necessarily, but some things should be done cooperatively for the good of everybody. And, you know, mental health care and health care in general is one.
Yeah, I think food is one.
Housing.
Schooling is one. The basic needs. Yeah, you know, we can and should provide a basic level of those things for everybody.
Yep.
Because that's what society needs. I remember one time when I was working with Council of Nonprofits, there were some people from Russia that came, and they did not understand the whole concept of nonprofits and volunteerism, because the government did everything, right? You know, so why would there be an organization do it? Well, the government doesn't do it, or they do it very little. But why would you volunteer to do it? And, you know, I said part of it was out of just altruism, you know. I wish I would have been more articulate to them, but it's out of self-interest. I want to live in a place where there's not a lot of violence. I want to live in a place where women aren't beaten. I don't want that kind of world. And my world is better if that's taken care of. My world is better if people are educated better. You know, even if I don't have kids in the school anymore, I want to live in a community where there's a lot of educated, smart people that understand the world. And
for me, it goes back to that previous conversation about community. It's my community, and I have a responsibility to be active and participating in how I want that community to look. And I can choose to sit home and do nothing and grumble, or I can get off my butt and try to do something.
More and more I do think that the bigger things get, the less functional they are.
You know, I was talking about labor stuff before, and I love the rhetoric of the old IWW, and I know all the, you know, I'd love to sing all the old IWW songs and that, you know, the old class stuff, and, you know, but it doesn't work anymore, you know? And their idea was, we'll have one big union. Every worker in the world will belong to the same union. And so it doesn't matter what country you're in, or, you know, if the carpenters go on strike, now the plumbers might still work. But it's like, no, we're all going on strike. But you start looking at what that stuff was. Can you imagine the bureaucracy? It's not functional. You know, and, you know who Pete Seeger is?
Yeah.
He's like one of the heroes, and he was a big labor guy in the 30s and 40s, and he was a big civil rights guy in the 40s and 50s, and he was a big environmental guy, and you know. And I got to interview him one time when I was at the Winnipeg Folk Festival doing stuff, and I was asking him about that, and he says, it's one struggle, you know, it's all one, doesn't matter where you pick it. And so it'd be pretty silly if, and he said he thinks of it like a log. Like we're trying to roll this log up a hill, right? And so we're all on this log lined up to roll it. And the only way we're going to do it is if we all roll it up together. So if I say, it's not a race issue, it's a class issue. So let go of your class. You know, you see it as gender or race. Let go of that and come over here where I am. Well, you can't all be in the same place and get it up the hill. You got to spread out.
Yeah.
But you also have to realize you're all on working on the same thing, and you all got to look up and down the line and say 1, 2, 3 roll. Rather, you know, you're looking at it as a gender issue or a race issue or a class issue or a health issue, or, you know, no matter what it is. The other thing he said about the labor stuff is, he said, I don't believe it's going to be one big union that's going to save the world. He said it's going to be a whole bunch of little bitty unions working together, you know, a whole bunch. And by union, not with a big U, you know, not even labor union, but people working together, a whole bunch of little organizations working together.
Yeah.
You don't have to all be on the same exact page in the same group, in the same, you just have to do your thing and do it well, but pay attention to the people around you and support the people around you doing similar kinds of things in other areas, you know. And that's what's going to save the world, not waiting until we all get on the, you know.
It's a slow process.
Yeah, and it's too slow. And again, you make progress, and then you get somebody who destroys it and sets you back a decade.
Yeah,
or two. You know, right, you know, but it's still a slow, it's getting better, you know, I mean.
So I want to pick your brain and switch a little bit about when Nicole and I would visit about food at the tribal college, and you were two cubes down, and mm-hmm. part of how we began to know each other more. You talked about, and you can see it here, you know, you were trying to be more food independent. Trying to, you know, I know that you have a history with Harmony Food Co-op and trying to provide for yourself. So in the realm of the socials, when do you think, if ever, we will get to the point that we have a right to food and we have a right to good, healthy food?
Oh, I don't know. Like you were saying that about other issues, it gets kind of like bought out. So like organic or healthy or any of those kind of things. Oh, okay, that's the trend. Now you can get it at Kmart.
Yep.
From China, right? You know, and it's healthy organic food, you know. So it gets compromised, you
right.
know. For that. And I don't know how you get past, I mean, it happens too with every movement.
It does.
Or all the fads of the kids, you know, like something gets cool and they do it to be different, and pretty soon it gets
everybody's
compromised. And,
everybody's doing it.
Right. Everybody used to wear love beads and now everybody's got tattoos and
yeah.
you know, or whatever it is, yeah. you know. It gets compromised, you know, and in a way that's a win, right? Because they accepted the idea, but they
right.
kind of corrupted it, you know, in doing that.
Yeah, they've taken away from the originality of it.
You know, but that goes for me, like, you know, I've always wanted to, I chose not to go into being a professional. If I had, I wouldn't have moved here. You know, and so like when I've gotten into professional jobs, I go so far and it's like, oh, wait a minute. what I'm really into is living on the land with my family. Mm-hmm. And it's like you can't do them both, you know. So I'm, my whole life has been kind of this identity back and forth, because that, you know, I get into those work situations and I want to do them and I'm passionate about them, and you to move up and you want to be, have more influence, you know.
Yeah,
I used to think that's why I went into training and teaching, because you can influence more than doing it yourself. That's why I went into management, because if you're managing a system and can affect other systems, you got more influence. But on the other hand, in my life, I'd start going that way and then think, I haven't got time to fix my house and garden. You know, I should, where, you know, so it's always that back and forth, because that's a full-time job. I wanted to be a hobo, and I didn't do it. So that's when I think I'm a failure. See, I failed at being a hobo and failed at being a dropout, because I get pulled off into these other areas. You know? But my own goal, and it's not, I can't say it's my family's goal, so you got to balance that.
Right.
Well, I would have been, actually, there was a joke I kind of tongue-in-cheek, half-jokingly, when we got married, told my wife's sister that I'd taken a vow of poverty and was taking her sister off to live in the woods and to live a life of poverty, and only partially tongue-in-cheek. But I'd be happy if I could, if you got the food you need, and what better food can I get than's in the garden? And I'm finally at a point that I think we could probably be pretty food, I mean, you're always gonna have to buy some things, but pretty darn food independent. I'm not that great of a hunter. But if I had more time at it, I'd get better. And there's meat you can raise, you know. So, I mean, I think it's, you could do that. But it took me years of having to work out to get the tools and build the garden, and, you know, to get to be able to do that. But I think that's the goal. One of my heroes said, you can never be free. If you own anything, you have to feed or paint. Right? Because they'd keep you from being free. But if you're really free, then like you said, food independent. I mean, what can be more basic? Energy, and as long as I got dead jack pine, and all I got to do is have gas for a chainsaw and keep it repaired, but I've got all the, I can stay warm in this winter. It's a luxury to also be able to use propane if I'm going to be gone.
Yes, it is. Know?
But you have everything you need. And what else do you need? Entertainment. Well, you got a guitar.
Yeah.
You got stories, you got board games, and can be pretty, work activity can be entertaining and fun if you're with people that
you enjoy
being with. I mean, you can be doing some dirty, nasty work, hard, sweaty work, if it's, can be fun and an activity, right?
If you're with people that
you don't
enjoy
have to
being
be bored, right? You know, so I mean, if you look at what you need, I mean, and that's an old Buddhist kind of way of thinking, is that you can either try to, you know, get everything, every desire you have, try to meet, or you can figure out what you need and be satisfied with.
So what do you think about, okay, the people need to recognize what they need, or does, as a society, the government need to? Because I'm looking at other governments where they have in their constitution the right to clean water, the right to food, the right to, you know, that Mother Nature has rights. Mm-hmm. So there are countries that have that in their constitution. So I was listening to NPR recently, and they had a show on the Constitution, and they had some constitutional experts, and they said that the authors of the Constitution would probably be shocked to think that we as a people had not changed our Constitution. That was just a beginning, that was just a start. Right. You know, when do we as a people say, hey, we could change this thing? When do we do that? Do we need to do that? Or do we need to, like, independently as an individual say, I have wants versus needs, and then identify them and live my life how I need to? Like, which is, what do you think is better, or what do you think would...
Well, I mean, if you get down, I mean, it's beyond even just government, the right to that. It's like humanity and the planet won't exist without clean air. Humanity and the planet won't exist without clean water, you know?
No.
And if you keep it at just the individuals doing that, this individual is infringing on my individuality to have clean air and clean water, because they want to strip Mother Earth of what she has, And I'm trying to preserve it, and we're trying to coexist, so I'm never going to have clean air and clean water.
It's kind of back to that, doing things on a small thing, because the other slogan that I love is think globally, but act locally.
Yeah. Oh, I love that slogan. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so if everybody's thinking of clean water's the thing, then you make sure, you know, what happens in the Necktie River.
Mm-hmm.
Becomes our thing, maybe.
Well, thank you so much, Dennis, for visiting with you today.
It was great.
I'm glad you think I'm cool.
You're cool.
This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.